Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello out there, everyone. Welcome to the Deeper Waters Podcast. I am Nick Peters, your host, hoping to bring you the very best in apologetics information today. And now, some of you might have seen the blog post I wrote advertising the show saying, this show might not have been. For those who don't know, it's been a rather difficult week here. I had a number of events happen that led me to the doctor to find out that I had an inflamed prostate, and it led to a lot of pain on my part, which we had two nights of very little sleep here, my wife and I both, because I was screaming most of the night. Yep, that's how bad it was. So bad that we actually went to the emergency room on Thursday to help get things taken care of, and I think things are good enough. I'm pushing here, but I've been able to function for the most part. I think I can handle it, and if my wife was right here, she could tell you that this is the kind of personality I have anyway. In fact, shortly after we got married sometime, I remember I had the flu, and I said, I need to get online. I need to be doing my work. I said, no, you need to rest. You need to rest. You had to make me rest because I'm that kind of personality. But we did end up still having a good Valentine's Day, get to exchange our gifts and such. Probably didn't get to go to a lot of places we want to, but hey, that's okay, you know, we've got each other here. Now, my guest today is Tom Gilson. Now, Tom Gilson does a lot of work with Ratio Christi. He's a National Field Director for Ratio Christi Student Apologetics Alliance, which puts him in charge of 100-plus campus chapters, and keep in mind, I have a chapter with Ratio Christi as well. It's not a campus chapter, but it's the internet chapter, and he's done so much work for in apologetics ministries, such as Campus Crusade for Christ, human resource leadership there, internet ministry director for military ministry, and published a number of works that we're going to be talking about, including being a co-editor of True Reason, Christian Response to the Challenge of Atheism. He's got a bachelor's in music education with an emphasis in trombone from Michigan State, which I think that could have been where Gary Habermas went to, and a master's in industrial and organizational psychology from the University of Central Florida. And he runs the blog Thinking Christian, which is consistently rated in the Technorati Top 100 Most Influential Religion Blogs. And today, we're going to be talking about the topic of Peter Boghossian and his book, A Manual for Creating Atheists. We'll be discussing True Reason some, but Peter Boghossian will be our main focus here. So, Tom, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good afternoon, Nick.
Welcome to the show. Glad to have you.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
Now, I've given some of your background and such. Is there anything you'd like to add about that? And also, would you like to tell our audience a little bit about how you got to be where you are today?
Well, sure. Yeah. I live in Ohio with my wonderful wife, Sarah, and we've got two college-age kids. Moved here from Virginia a couple years ago. But that's not what you meant by where I am today. Just thought I'd mention it. We're enjoying some warm temperatures all the way up in the 20s now for a change. if that means warm to you. It does to us after what we've been through lately. Anyway, I was really influenced by apologetics when I first came to Christ, because I had been raised in a Christian home and had actually turned away from Christianity because of a lot of reasons, one of which was that I tried to be a Christian and it wasn't working for me, and I finally decided it might not be true. But I met some Christians on my dorm floor at Michigan State University who were actually living the Christian life, seemed to be enjoying it, and they intrigued me because I thought that you couldn't do that. I didn't think you could enjoy Christianity. But I also wanted to know whether it was real, and they gave me a copy of Evidence of Man's Verdict by Josh McDowell. This was back in 1974, a good long time ago. Josh came to our campus shortly after that, and in between then, I came to faith in Christ. So Josh McDowell is an apologist, someone who was one of the early leaders in our contemporary movement of defense for the faith, was really influential on me early on. I came on staff with Campus Crusade for Christ, which is what it was called then, back in 1979, and remained with Campus Crusade or Crew until last summer. The last thing that I was doing with Crew was strategic planning, internally and also externally, some of it with Chuck Colson's ministry. And I prayed a prayer February of 2009. And the prayer was this: I'm interested in the strategy and I'm interested in apologetics. Do they belong together? And it wasn't a prayer request. It was a prayer question. Do they belong together? I didn't have anything in mind other than that. And from that point, God has answered with a big, resounding yes, where I had opportunities to be involved in strategy discussions with the National Conference on Christian Apologetics, with Point, of course, as I already mentioned, and now with Ratio Christi, where I'm leading and co-leading along with, of course, the other people that have been with it longer, the new Student Apologetics Alliance that's out there and has grown explosively up to the 100 campuses we have now. So that's my short, condensed version of my story. It doesn't include the blogging and writing and stuff, but we'll get to that whenever.
Okay. Now, I said before we're talking about Peter Boghossian, and now there could be some listeners out there who say, Peter Boghossian, who is that guy? I don't know about him. Tell us about Peter.
Right. Peter Boghossian is he's got a doctorate in education, but he's currently an instructor in philosophy at Portland State University. He has recently published the Manual for Creating Atheists, as he calls it, with Pitchstone Press. He's doing what could only be called advocacy for atheism on the internet and in speeches and in this book around the, and he claims that he's not so much advocating for atheism as he is advocating for clear, rational thinking. Well, we'll get into whether he's actually doing that very effectively. But the Manual for Creating Atheists was published just before, it was about November 1 of last year. It's been a book that's gathered and garnered a whole lot of excitement among the atheist community online as the first book that really explains how to, can we use the word evangelize, in people into atheism.
Yes, I think we can.
Okay. I don't think it's good news, as the word evangelism really refers to in its original meaning. But it's a book that explains how you can talk people out of faith and do it in a supposedly winsome and caring manner as you help people understand how to come to more rational methods of thinking. That's how he would perceive himself.
Now, he's
how
also...
How I would perceive him might be different.
Yeah. Now, he's also, in fact, thinking of doing this with a television show, isn't he?
He's been saying that, yes, for a month or two, and I've been watching his Facebook page to see when it happens, because what he wants to do on his television show is display videos of his conversations with believers and show how he creates atheists. Now, he's not saying that he will have a conversation and people will instantly become an atheist, but he will. His point is that he can move people in that direction by getting them to the point where they can doubt their faith. And he claims that he can do that in a matter of just a few minutes, and he wants to put that out there where everybody can see it on video. That's his plan.
I talked about that some last week with my guest, Don Johnson, and about how he had said that he's also planning to come into area churches, to which as soon as I heard that, I said, oh, please, please, come to my church. I want you to come to church. And, yeah. And sad thing is,
I would love for him to come where he likes to sit in the middle seat on airplanes, hoping that he can sit next to a Christian and talk them out of their faith, or at least talk them into doubting their faith methods. And I would love to sit next to him on an airplane. I think that would be a very good conversation. Sure.
Yeah, but the sad reality is, unfortunately, most Christians are indeed totally unprepared for what Boghossian has to say. And I've said before that it seems like Boghossian is going after low-hanging fruit, and it's the fault of the churches, unfortunately, that we are producing just low-hanging fruit.
Right. And in order to explain that, we probably ought to describe and talk for a while about what it is that he does and how he approaches his conversations with believers.
Sure.
It's really quite simple. It, not only is it simple, but it's actually the same thing that I've heard Josh McDowell do. The difference is in where they land it at the end of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
What he'll do is he'll ask, now, do you believe that Jonah lived in the belly of the big fish for 3 days? Or do you believe that Jesus walked on water? And the believer will say yes, and he'll say, well, how do you know that? And the typical answer he will get will be something like, well, it's in the Bible, or because I have faith. And then he'll say, well, how do you know that you can trust that? How do you know that that's a good way to know something? Where that usually goes with believers is eventually to, well, I believe it because God said so, which he will again say, how do you know? If you ask how do you know often enough, the believer will usually say, I don't have an answer. Or they'll circle back around to something they already said before, like I have faith, which is really actually, his point is that that's very weak. Now, Josh McDowell does that. I've seen him do that with high school students, and his point is, yeah, that's very weak too. The difference between them is that Josh says there is a strong way to answer that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Peter Boghossian, in fact, makes much about the idea of faith, doesn't he? Since
right.
His definition of faith is often pretending to know things you don't know.
Right. He has a dual definition, and I'm looking it up here now in his book. It's the chapter 2, the beginning. It's really the beginning of the book. Chapter 1 is more or less introductory. And he says that it is either belief without evidence, or it is what you just said, pretending to know things you don't know. Either way, it is something that is worth nothing. It should be totally dismissed, and people should get over it. It is a virus of the mind. It is a cognitive pathology. It is a doxastic sickness. That's one of his favorite big words, doxastic, which means having to do with belief. It's a belief sickness.
Now, he says that this is indeed what faith is. Is he right?
He does. You know, there are a lot of ways to look at faith, and it's a very multifaceted term. It's got all kinds of connotations, and I think that he's probably got a good description of the way some people believe. I don't want to make it the case that faith is always well-founded, because then I'd have to say that Christian scientists' faith is well-founded, and Muslims and Mormons' faith is well-founded. Where he goes wrong with respect to Christianity in particular is this. He says that it is pretty much always a case of pretending to know things you don't know, always a case of belief without evidence. He says it is definitive of faith that it is pretending to know. So that in every case, people who are who have religious faith are always believing without evidence and always pretending to know what they don't know. And that's where he goes wrong. I don't think he's wrong in saying that sometimes faith is like that, but he makes it always that way, and I have strong disagreement with that. And I think we have good reasons for disagreeing with that.
The Greek word translated in the New Testament as faith is pistis. And I have been having my own fun on Peter Boghossian's Facebook page, talking with this street epistemologist, and we can talk about that later.
Mm-hmm.
But I've asked him
repeatedly,
he said, okay, show me one New Testament or Greek lexicon where pistis is defined as belief without evidence or pretending to know something you don't know. Strangely enough, no one's taken me up on that offer.
Well, it gets worse than that, because he says that we have to be very careful not to let religious people get away with redefining faith to mean trust. What does pistis mean in the Greek, Nick?
Trust.
What does pistis mean? It means trust. Well, he's saying, well, we can't let you redefine it as trust. It's always meant trust. He's playing with the words. He's reinventing the words and blaming us for reinventing the words. It's really dishonest. We'll get into more of that, too. We got some time to talk here, and I'm looking forward to more of that. He's really actually trying to change the definition of the word, and he's doing that quite openly. If you listen to him in the right interviews and podcasts, he's not saying that we're he's not actually saying that Christians have illegitimately changed the definition. He's saying he wants to change the definition.
Of course, he's not alone in that. Unfortunately, the new atheists like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and others have the exact same definition of faith, and he's just trumpeting out exactly what they say.
Yep. Well, and you know who they go to as their sources for their definition is each other. They go to each other. In his book, he quotes John Loftus as a credible source for the definition of faith. Well, John Loftus is a new atheist himself. He doesn't go into the real literature on faith. He doesn't take the real meaning of faith seriously. What he does, what he's doing is an authoritarian move whereby his fiat, his say-so, we need to change the way we think of faith.
Well, I'm thinking about this also today because I listened before our show started to the latest Unbelievable podcast with David Robertson taking down Matt Dillahunty of the Atheist Experience. And David Robertson didn't let him get away with this redefinition of faith. And Dillahunty said, well, this is the definition of faith I encounter most often from Christians. And I'm here and I'm thinking, well, that might be what you're encountering most often, but does that mean that's what the original offer is meant it to be?
Right. And you can't fairly, you cannot, in intellectual honesty with full legitimacy, you cannot take the weakest, the least knowledgeable people as the representative of the way good thinking is among the knowledgeable people. I said that in an awkward manner. He's really doing what you already said. Is he's picking low-hanging fruit, people who don't know how to articulate what their faith really is because they haven't worked it through. But people who know how to articulate it, people who have studied it, for us, he's just obviously, he's pulling a power play on the definition of the word. It's wrong.
Well, with that, we're going to take a quick break. Coming up from our first break, my guest is Tom Gilson. We're talking about Peter Boghossian's Manual for Creating Atheists. And we'll be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
And we're back. My guest is Tom Gilson. We're talking about Peter Boghossian's book, A Manual for Creating Atheists. And you were just saying that you don't go to those who are like the common denominator and say, well, this is obviously what the whole of the movement says. And I was saying, it'd be kind of like if I went on YouTube, looked at a lot of these teenage atheist videos of them ranting and raving about Bible contradictions or anything else out there and say, yep, that's the best of atheism out there. If I want to know what atheism is, that's where I go to.
Right.
Now,
it's
he
a
also,
weak way to deal with it. Yeah.
He also connects this with statements that he calls deepities.
Right.
Could you explain what a deepity is?
Well, I probably ought to look up what he says a deepity is. Randall Rouser did a good discussion on that in his in a blog post recently. He on page 21 of his book, he says a deepity is a statement that looks profound but isn't. They appear true at one level but are meaningless on other levels. Like, for example, is Paul Tillich: faith is the act in which reason reaches ecstatically beyond itself. Or Brian McLaren: having faith is really about seeking something beyond faith itself.
Mm.
Those are good examples of bad descriptions of faith.
Mm.
And so he does have some good examples of bad descriptions of faith. And he also quotes Hebrews 11:1, which he calls a deepity. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. The problem with quoting Hebrews 11:1, is that it doesn't really, he says it doesn't say much, and I think if you'd look at just that one sentence, he's probably right. It wasn't meant to say much in just that one sentence. It is a sentence in the middle of a book that it does make a lot of sense in context, and it doesn't make a lot of sense out of context. Somebody once on the internet recently accused me of, quote, playing the context card. He didn't want me to bring the context into this very discussion. I was like, why?
Would this
why
by any chance be James Lindsay?
It might be James Lindsay, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
We had some interesting discussion.
It always surprises me, these kinds of people are saying, why would you be scared to get more information about what you're talking about if what you're saying is true? And I say the same thing with people in biblical studies. I say, if you really think the Bible is true, you shouldn't be afraid to look at the best scholarship out there in the Bible. It's not going to destroy your faith if it's true. If, on the other hand, you think it might not be true, well, you're not going to want to look.
And the other way of looking at that error is that he is believing without evidence. He's believing that he understands what Hebrews 11:1 says without gathering the necessary relevant evidence. So he's choosing to believe without evidence, which is what they say is the fault that faith makes.
And
it's
silly. And I found it rather interesting that he apparently did some research on what the word evidence means and looked that up, but he didn't do any on what faith itself means.
Yeah, something's lacking there.
Yeah. Now, since we've said there is a proper context, how about we deal with that? What is really being said in Hebrews 11?
What is the author saying in Hebrews 11:1? It's, I should have opened my Bible before I started raising that topic. I can tell you this much, that he is not talking about belief without evidence. Because we know that, because earlier in the book of Hebrews, and I'm going to find it, I think, in chapter 2, And as I turn pages here, it says, chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation after it was first at the first spoken through the Lord? It was confirmed to us by those who heard, God also bearing witness with them, evidence both by signs and wonders, and by gifts and miracles of the Holy Spirit according to his own will. He also says in Hebrews 11, he goes on to talk about various evidences that people had for their faith, the author of Hebrews does. For example, we have Moses as listed as an example of faith. Moses saw the burning bush. He had the rod. He had the miracles, the plagues, the crossing of the Red Sea. These were evidences for faith. The Bible is not opposed to faith being tied to evidence. So what is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, as it says in the New American Standard? It's basically a way of saying that this is something that we've got that's solid to hold on to for things that we hope for and haven't seen yet. But it's not saying we're holding on to it as if it's just a vapor. It's something solid.
You know, when I've done my looking at this passage also, I've said that Hebrews is a book written because some people are thinking of abandoning the old covenant, the new covenant, and going back to the old covenant of Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And the end of Hebrews 10 is talking about people that are some in the danger of falling away. He says, but we expect better of you. And what is it? It's these people hadn't seen the rewards of their faith. They hadn't seen the promises come true, because they were in the future, and you can't see the future. And so what he's saying is, well, you're not seeing the promises. Well, guess what? You're in a great line. Here are several other people who trusted in God based on what they had seen, but not seeing the conclusion. And that was the kind of trust that he was talking about.
Yeah, that's a good additional, really contextual way of looking at it. What it isn't about is faith is the evidence, which is what they want to say is, well, if faith is the evidence, and if that's all the evidence you've got, then you don't have any evidence for faith. That's not what Hebrews is about. It's not what anything in the New Testament is about. Jesus, the doubting Thomas incident is all often brought up as the idea from the book of John that that Jesus affirmed those who believe without evidence in response to Thomas's request for evidence. He said in John 20:29, because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are those who did not see and yet believed. Well, is that affirming the idea of belief without evidence? Let's read verses 30 and 31. Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. The book moves immediately from that statement of Jesus into an affirmation of testimony as evidence for belief. The Bible is all about evidence.
In fact, I read this statement last night. It comes from Origen, where he said, those who have not seen and have believed are more blessed than those who have seen and believed because they have misconstrued what the Lord said to Thomas at the end of John's Gospel. Blessed are those who have not seen and have believed, for it is not possible that those who have not seen and have believed are more blessed than those who have seen and believed. According to their interpretation, at least, then, those who came after the apostles are more blessed than the apostles, which is the most ridiculous of all things.
Right.
Which he's saying that the apostles had the best evidence they could have, the experience of being with Jesus for 3 years. And it would be ludicrous to have John think, but you know, if you believe without seeing all these things, you're even better off than we are.
Right. The mistake that Thomas made wasn't that he was insisting on evidence. The mistake was that he wasn't accepting the evidence he already had, which was the testimony of his best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And also Jesus' predictions, too.
Yeah. And I was about to add another one, not just that, but Jesus' own prediction. Thomas had evidence. The problem wasn't wanting more evidence. It was rejecting the evidence he already had.
Right. Yeah. Now, what happened to me when I began talking about this on the Internet of the fact that in the Bible, faith was always tied to evidence, what happened to me was people said, well, you can't use the Bible to show that. You can't use the Bible to show evidence for faith, and because you have to show that the Bible is true. You can't expect us to believe the Bible along with you. Well, okay, that's not the point at this stage in the discussion. There are evidences for belief in God, but at that point in the discussion, I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about the historic way the word faith has been used. In the Bible, when people spoke of faith, they spoke of something that was tied to evidence. When they went on down through history, Origen, like you said, who is just a couple centuries after Christ, and Aquinas and Augustine, and all the way through to today, when people have spoken about faith, they've talked about something that was tied to evidence. What that means in itself is not directly that faith has evidence for it. What it does mean is that the word faith does not mean belief without evidence. It means that the definition that he used is a new one, a novel one, that's disconnected from the literary and historical conventional use of the word. So
it's
he's changing the definition.
It's quite amazing that here you're trying to have a discussion about what the words in the Bible mean and what the Bible is trying to say, and you're not allowed to use supposedly what the Bible says to do that.
Right. Yeah. What does the Bible say faith is? Well, I start to answer, oh, no, no, you can't use the Bible.
Yeah,
right.
In fact, the position that people like Bogosian and others take, no New Testament scholar would take that position. I mean, none of them would say, you know, I don't believe the Bible is true. I don't believe the Bible is the Word of God. Therefore, the Bible is absolutely useless to understanding the history
right.
of Jesus. Not one of them would take
right.
that.
Right. And then you get to the contemporary atheist movement where they're talking about the definition of faith, and they will open up the dictionary and say, what does the dictionary say about faith? And they'll look at the second definition, and it says that it is belief without proof. And they'll say, see, the dictionary says it's belief without evidence. And I say, does it say evidence or proof? And they'll say, well, it says belief without evidence, belief without proof, as if belief without proof and belief without evidence are the same thing.
Right.
Well, first of all, the dictionary doesn't rule over Christian thinking. And secondly, proof and evidence are two different words with different meanings.
Mm-hmm. In the medieval mindset, for instance, they said there were things you could know, and there are things you believed, and what you knew could be demonstrated. They'd say, for instance, you could demonstrate that God exists by using reason
mm-hmm.
alone, but by using reason alone,
yeah.
you could not demonstrate that God is a Trinity. You believe that he's a Trinity, and you believe the Bible is valid in that statement, but you can't demonstrate it. But it doesn't mean anything. They'd say, we don't know God's a Trinity. They certainly claim that as knowledge, but they wouldn't claim to know it the same way.
Right. Well, yeah, and no, we don't know it by reason the same way that we know that there is a God, but there are good reasons to know it, which have
mm-hmm.
to do with the trustworthiness of and the authority of the Bible as demonstrated through other means,
mm-hmm.
which, going back to Bogosian's question of how do you know that Jonah lived in the whale, or how do you know that in the big fish, how do you know that Jesus walked on water, I'm afraid it might seem flippant, but it's the same way that Bogosian knows most of what he knows for example, how do you know, how does anybody know, except for a few limited number of scientists, how does anybody know that the core of the Earth is made of molten iron and nickel? It's not because we've observed it. It's not because we've run the tests. It's because someone told us, and because we considered them trustworthy, credible, authoritative. We figured that it was safe to believe them. That's how I know Jesus walked on the water, is because someone said so, and for other reasons, independent of that, I think that I can believe them, because there's good reason to believe that the people who wrote that in the Gospels were telling the truth. And yep. These are the kind of reasons that you probably talked about on other podcasts frequently. It's not directly our topic here, of course.
Yeah, I'm thinking I've got a ready example immediately here of how this works. As I said, I was in the hospital earlier this week with an ER visit, and when I go there, the doctor says, here's some medication, take this, here's what you do. And I go home and do it, and I say, is that going to work? Yep. Well, how do you know that? The doctor said so. Well, how do you know they're right? Well, they're a doctor. I figure they should trust them. I'm not going to go around and say, well, I'm going to go and I'm going to consult 20 doctors first. I'm going to see what they all say, weigh out their evidences, and then I'm going to make a decision. No, by that time, I could be in a whole lot more pain.
Right.
And probably a whole lot more broke as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking out the window, and I'm looking at trees, and I'm looking at an evergreen tree that I believe has a deep taproot. How do I know that? Because someone told me, and I believe them. I haven't dug the tree up.
And
how do you know what the capital of Libya is? Well, maybe you've been there, or maybe you've trusted somebody who told you, or a map that said so. This is not unusual. This is an okay way to know things. This is normal. The question is whether we have good reason to trust the biblical authors, and we could talk about that for hours, too, but that is the question. It is not belief without evidence. It's belief with the evidence of trustworthy testimony.
You know, I would really be wondering if I met someone who says that the sun goes around the earth instead of the earth going around the sun, but if I was asked point blank, said, well, how do you know the earth goes around the sun? Can you make a scientific argument for that? I would be absolutely stuck. I could not make an argument like that. But at the same time, if I said, well, I'm just going to remain agnostic on that issue, that wouldn't be accepted.
No, yeah, it would be unthinking. It would, yeah, you can accept authority. So,
For the sake of argument, in fact, we could even say our reasons for trusting in Christ, trusting in that he rose from the dead, could be wrong, but that's a far cry from saying we're believing without reasons.
Right. And it's a far cry from pretending to believe, too. It's not. Suppose we're wrong. Are we pretending to believe? No, we're just mistaken. And there is a difference between being mistaken, being wrong, and being in pretense. Mm-hmm. So, because otherwise, you know, suppose Boghossian got something wrong once on a, you know, maybe he studied Latin, and maybe he got something wrong on a test in Latin class. Was he pretending to know? No, he was just wrong. He's got it all. He's choosing words that are intended to make it look ridiculous instead of being the kind of words that you can discuss and ask questions like, well, maybe are we right or are we wrong? Those are things you can discuss, but when you change it to pretending or lacking in evidence completely, you shut off the conversation.
We're going to take a quick break right now. I'm Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Tom Gilson of Thinking Christian. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet.
The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, CYIWorldwide.com. Rock Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And we're back. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast, and you're listening to our show right now with Tom Gilson talking about Peter Boghossian's book, A Manual for Creating Atheist. And now, I'd like to give out the number for our show. It's 714-242-5180. And for all we know, Tom, we could have some street epistemologist calling in then. What exactly are street epistemologists?
Street epistemologists, well, let's explain the word epistemology. That's the other favorite big word of Peter Boghossian. Epistemology is the philosophical study of how we know what we know, whether we know what we know. It's the study of knowledge. The reason he talks about epistemology is because he calls faith a bad epistemology. It's a bad way of coming to knowledge. We can talk about whether he has a good way of coming to knowledge later on, because I've got some thoughts on that. But what he wants people to do with his training is to go out in the street and to explore people's way of coming to know the things that they believe through faith. And so these are epistemologists that are trained to do this on the street. And the training is to do things like what we explored earlier, to ask questions like, do you believe Jesus walked on the water? And to trace that question down until people get to the point where they say, well, I don't know, and to try to nudge them away from faith that way.
From what I've seen on Boghossian's Facebook page when I've been interacting with his friends there, is that the street epistemologists are woefully unequipped.
Right. Well, they're probably equipped to handle some the believers who just don't have a good answer to their basic questions.
But
that's
that went
low-hanging fruit again.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me, but when it comes to so many issues, these street epistemologists are really uninformed. They haven't wrestled with philosophy. They haven't wrestled with the history, and usually it's just a trumpeting of science, which I suspect most of them haven't even really wrestled with that. Why do you think, first off, do you think this is accurate? And second, why do you think it is or isn't?
Well, I'm not going to make a general statement about street epistemologists, because I haven't been on the Facebook page that you've been on to see the same things you are. Generally speaking, what I've encountered with atheists, and this is the topic of the book True Reason that's coming out in a couple of weeks, is that their reasoning skills are poor. They tend to conclude, they tend to define reason according to the conclusions you come to, rather than your discourse, your reasoning process. So that if you decide to believe nothing except for what science can tell you, what empirical research can tell you, then you're a reasonable person. But you can't define reason according to what conclusion you come to. You have to define reasoning skills according to the practice of the skill of reasoning. Mm-hmm. And that's a mistake a lot of atheists make.
I often refer to it as a sort of atheistic hubris, but I see that a lot of people think they're right on their conclusion automatically by virtue of their being an atheist.
Yeah. And not only are they right, but they're reasonable. So you have the Sam Harris Project Reason. You have the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science. You have the Reason Rally, which I went to, the atheist rally on the Washington Mall back in March 2012. And they've claimed the name Reason for themselves. They consider themselves the party of reason. That's why we wrote the book. It's a collaborative book, True Reason, which was to challenge their claim on being the party of reason, simply in virtue of the fact that they don't practice it very well.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think they don't practice it well?
I don't. That's a that's a psychological question that even though I've got a master's in psych, I'm not going to touch. It could be a spiritual problem, a spiritual blindness thing. So I am touching it, at least to the extent of speculating on it.
Maybe I should explain the difference. Okay. Not what do you think their intentions are, but what evidence do you see at least you think these guys are saying they're championing reason, but really they're not championing reasoning well?
Well, Boghossian's a great example of this, actually. And he's an ironic example because he says that he's not really out to create atheists. He's out to promote good, solid, critical thinking so that people use the proper epistemology, so that people are making their knowledge decisions based on good processes for coming to knowledge. And he's a professor who teaches a critical thinking course at Portland State University. But then, for example, he's got a lecture online, a couple of them. One of them he gave at Portland State University several months ago, where he's supposed to be demonstrating good critical thinking. And in this talk at Portland State, he says he's talking about how people come to faith. And there are three core reasons, he says, for why one believes one's faith tradition is true. Reason number one is miracles. We're going to examine a few miracles. That's a quote. Now, here's where I pause and I say, now, if someone says, okay, we're going to examine a few miracles that would be reasons for us to believe our faith tradition is true, Nick, what would come to your mind as being miracles that we use to support the idea our faith tradition is true?
Resurrection, immediately.
Resurrection, okay. This is what he said. The first one was transubstantiation, and the second one was tongues. Transubstantiation.
You know, I'm
okay.
Just.
What in the world is transubstantiation? I can tell you, but there's a lot of. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's supposedly where the elements of communion really turn into the body and blood of Christ.
Right, that's a Roman Catholic doctrine which a lot of us don't agree with in the first place. And in the second place, those who do believe in transubstantiation do not use it as evidence of miracles because the outward appearance, what they call the accidents in the philosophical language, everybody knows that those stay the same. There's no evidence there, and nobody claims there's evidence there. But Boghossian says we use transubstantiation as evidence, and it's really crummy evidence. Same with tongues. I don't know of anybody in the apologetic community who uses tongues as evidence for faith. Boghossian says we do, and he says it's crummy evidence. Now, why don't we use transubstantiation and tongues as evidence? Because we know those aren't good evidence, and he's saying that we're calling them good evidence. What he's doing in this role of the critical thinking professor is he's taking what they call straw man arguments, which is a logical fallacy, and he's parading it for everybody, and he's using it to knock down our beliefs when what he's knocking down is a horrible distortion of our beliefs. It's a very poor demonstration of critical thinking. He is not using good reason.
When I've been on his Facebook page engaging with a lot of these street epistemologists, I've said when the question of miracles comes up, I said, okay, if you're concerned about miracles in general, here's what you do. Go get Craig Keener's two-volume book, Miracles, go through it, and then write a serious refutation of it. And usually what they'll do is they'll probably just go to a website, look up some of the miracles and miracles they think are just silly. Then trumpet both sides like, well, see, these are nonsense, therefore I don't need to read this book.
They'll brush it aside. But the point with Boghossian is that he is a very poor example of good reasoning. He takes, he redefines faith by his own power play. He redefines faith. There's another one example of a great example of him doing this in a lecture he gave to the humanists of Greater Portland area, where he says. That there are only 10 things that can be said in favor of faith. Only 10 things. He only has time to tell us about 5 of them. You know what the first two are? These are the best things that can be said for faith. One is life has no meaning without faith, and the second one is I'm having a crisis of faith. He's telling the atheist in his crowd that those are the best things that Christians can say for faith. And he's wrong, and he knows he's wrong. I am sure he knows he's wrong, and he's propagating a lie and parading it as good thinking, and he's not doing, he's not practicing what he preaches. I could say it in stronger terms, but I'll be careful.
I was just commenting on a blog recently in response to someone who was talking about the God delusion, and they were agreeing about, yeah, well, it's good for dealing with low-hanging fruit. And I said, yeah, thing is, Richard Dawkins, he's not doing any service to Christians, which, of course, he doesn't expect to do. The worst part is he's not doing any service to atheists as well. In fact, he's lowering their intellectual standards by having them take on only the worst representations of arguments for Christianity or in theism and thinking he's knocking it down. And by doing such a horrid job with the arguments for God's existence and thinking he's doing a great one, because any atheist who reads that and says, oh, well, Richard Dawkins has said the final word, they've done themselves a disservice. They've lowered their standards.
Right. And, you know, I'll come back to the true reason book again. I wish we'd had time to put Boghossian in there in a chapter, but the timing didn't work out right for us. And, you know, it's available on Amazon now, but it's not shipping until the end of this month or early next month. True Reason. But
it'll be available on Kindle, too.
Yes. No, actually, well, there's two different versions. The Kindle version is already available. The print version has two additional chapters. And they are two different editions, and you can't get one in the other format. It's two different editions. Over and over again, the atheists are saying that they're the party of reason, as I already mentioned. And you have people like Sam Harris in a debate with William Lane Craig. Sam Harris is the head of Project Reason. Craig comes into this debate explaining some very logically oriented reasons to believe. And what the debate was about was whether you need to have God in order for there to be ethical realities. And Craig's approach was logic and reason. Harris's approach was basically an appeal to emotion. Harris was the one who's supposed to be the representative of Project Reason. Now suppose Craig was wrong. Suppose Craig's reasoning was all crummy and bad and awful. Harris could have met him on that playing field and said, no, you're wrong. But he didn't. He changed. It's like Craig hit him a fly ball, and Craig's out, and Harris is out there in the outfield, and he's back where he could catch the fly ball and put him out. And what does he do? He puts a football on the ground and tries to drop kick a field goal. He's playing a different game. But Craig's playing the game that's got Harris's Project Reason on it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm thinking about how so often I've been on the page, and even Boghossian himself has made his claim that he said that Christian apologetics, for instance, starts with confirmation bias. I mean, the atheist apologetics seems to start the same way, and when I'm talking with his street epistemologists, I'm saying, look, you can discuss if I have a bias and such all you want to if I'm looking at things differently. Here's my better suggestion to you. Let's discuss the data. Let's discuss the evidence, and let's see what we've got.
Right. Yeah, I don't think that either side should say, I am free of confirmation bias. That's a human failing. There's all kinds of attribution errors we can make, and it's very, very difficult for us as humans to get past our preferred beliefs. And that is something that you and I as Christians are prone to. We will see things our way. But for them to make a blanket statement that we're the ones who are guilty of it is also psychologically naive. And you have said exactly the correct thing. The way to protect yourself from confirmation bias is to look at the data.
In fact, what I've told them is, my main area is in your biblical scholarships. So I said, here's the scholars that I've read. Here's the ones I've read that are non-Christian, that are liberals, that are atheists, what have you, that disagree with me. And yes, I've also written responses to them. Can you please tell me what you've done on the other end? And
right.
They generally haven't read anything. As soon as I get most of them questioning even the existence of Jesus himself, I realize, I know what kind of crowd I'm dealing with here.
Right. And Boghossian, in his manual for creating atheists, says, he's using sources like Richard Dawkins,
mm-hmm.
and John Loftus for his definition, and Richard Carrier. These
mm-hmm.
are fellow atheists for his definition of faith, and he has not engaged with any historic Christian or
mm-hmm.
other religious scholarship on the definition of faith. It's the same thing you were just describing. He has not paid any attention to the full panoply of scholarship on this question.
Mm-hmm. I think one example he uses of confirmation bias on page 73 of his book is Gary Habermas. And as soon as I read that in there, I wanted to bust out laughing. Because I know Gary.
Can I read the quote, or do you want to?
Please do read it.
Every, in italics, religious apologist is epistemically debilitated, means handicapped in their knowledge, by an extreme form of confirmation bias. Gary Habermas, for example, exemplifies this cognitive malady. Habermas alleges to believe, and I think he actually does believe, that there's sufficient evidence to warrant belief in him, historical Jesus, and the miracles attributed to him. And he goes down later. He does this because he starts with a foundational belief first, Christ's divinity and the truth of Scripture, then conveniently sidesteps logic and reason backward from his belief. That's just not an accurate description of how Habermas does his work. He just
I've talked with Gary several times. He wasn't the guy who married my wife and I, after all.
Yeah.
And so we're good friends, and I know his story. His story was a story of wrestling with doubt for several years, and then he just said, I'm going to study resurrection, that's the linchpin, because he said, some people were coming to say, well, here's something about Noah's Ark, here's something about the Exodus, and that's good, that doesn't sell the mantle. It was his study of the resurrection. In fact, when he did his PhD, he was told, you can make a case for resurrection, just don't have it be the argument that the Bible says so. So that's fine,
mm-hmm.
fair enough. And so when I read Peter Boghossian saying this about Gary Habermas, I think, you really don't know what you're talking about, especially when he said that he thinks there's enough evidence to warrant an historical Jesus, which I mean, if you're skeptical about the historical Jesus, you definitely don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, that one's running wild through the atheist community, too, that we don't know if there was an historical Jesus. Well, I wrote a paper on this, and Dan Wallace of the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts took a look at it, and I put a line in there that said something like, there are very few scholars or very few credible scholars who doubt the existence of the historical Jesus. He crossed it out, and he said, there are no scholars with any credibility who doubt the existence of the historical Jesus. So I was corrected on that. Now Dan's a Christian, and maybe he's got his bias too, but I know that he runs in circles where that belief will be challenged, and he couldn't get away with it if it wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't do that in scholarship.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back. We'll be continuing talking with Tom Gilson about Peter Boghossian. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back with Tom Garrison, who's our guest this week. But if you're listening next week, my guest is going to be Lynn Kowick out of Wheaton. She's a female New Testament scholar up there, and we are going to be talking about Jesus and women, and probably the New Testament and women overall as well. So it's going to be a very interesting show. I hope you're going to be here next week when we have Lynn Kowick on to talk about Jesus and women. Yeah. Now, getting back to Peter Boghossian, right before the Gary Habermas thing on page 71, he gives a favorite strategy of his strategies, and it's one that I just love looking at for the subtitle of a section. It's two words: avoid facts.
Okay. Right. Mm-hmm. What page is that on again?
It's on page 71.
Oh, there it is. Okay, page 71, yeah. Right. Yeah, and I heard him say that again on another podcast that I listened to, or an interview I listened to. And the idea, he's actually on a tactically brilliant course when he says that. By the way, the reason Boghossian matters is not because he's got any philosophical shots going for him. I don't think he's got any credibility there. The reason he matters is because he knows something about persuasion theory and strategy and tactics. Mm-hmm. So that whether he knows what he's talking about or not, he's got a way of being persuasive with and mobilizing people to be persuasive.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those tactics from his studies in persuasion theory, is you don't want to put people back on their heels. You don't want them backed into a corner. You don't want them being defensive of God in particular. So you don't talk about whether there's a God. You talk about whether their ways of understanding reality, their epistemologies, are effective epistemologies. People are hardwired to defend their belief in God. People have not spent any time defending their epistemologies.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, because who even knows the word?
Right.
Who stands up and dies for their epistemology? We don't have any martyrs for epistemology. And so that's an area that we are willing to let ourselves be vulnerable in. And so he says, approach that, and people are more vulnerable, and in a good way. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but that's his avenue, and you won't get defenses raised against you the way you would by attacking the facts that people believe.
Yeah,
I think he's on a good track there, in the tactical sense.
We should say we don't have a problem with Peter Boghossian wanting to share atheism or get people to be atheists. I mean, if he thinks atheism is true, that's what he should be doing. What we have a problem with is that we don't think his reasoning's very good, and unfortunately, too many people in the church are going to be unequipped to deal with that.
Yeah, that's a fair way of putting it. I believe in Jesus Christ. I don't have any apologies for that, but if somebody could come along and say that that there's a good reason not to believe in Christ, I would want them to say it if they said it well. And,
right.
You know, I've got college-age kids who, you know, if they have any questions about whether Christianity is true, I hope they face those questions head-on and hear the best reasons to doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they make their decisions.
Mm-hmm.
We've had that conversation recently, by the way.
Yeah, I've even said I think it's really great to be able to go into a bookstore and look at the Christian section and not be afraid of anything there, as if it would destroy your faith, and just pick it up and say, yeah, yeah, this looks like it could be interesting.
Sure. Yeah, why not? You know, Nick, I am, I'm a great believer in questions. I look at what Jesus did in the New Testament, and he asked question after question. He had more questions in response to people than he had straight answers. There's a reason for this. It's not because he was lacking in answers. It's that he wanted to make sure that he gave answers to people when they were ready for answers. And if they weren't ready for answers, he would goad them with a question. Well, and I'm not talking about his sermons. I'm talking about his face-to-face kind of conversations with people. But questions bring out people's thinking, and they get people to interact with what they believe, with what they know, with what they doubt, and it drives people to think more deeply. I am fully in favor of that. And if that was a, if it's an atheist question, great. If it's a doubting question, fine. Face it. Go to the answers. If you can find them, look for the answers.
What I've told people before, in fact, is that I'm opposed to atheists who go around and give people bad arguments against Christianity and bad arguments for atheism, but I'm also opposed to Christians who go around and give bad arguments for Christianity and bad arguments for atheism.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just opposed to bad arguments, period.
I'm opposed to bad arguments, too. I agree. I'm opposed to sloppy thinking. I don't think that there are any hard questions out there that Christianity is stuck with. I don't think there are any questions out there that we can't answer from a good, solid perspective. But so I think that we have nothing to fear from questions. The most thing we have to fear is not facing reality. And God, if God is not real, we ought to accept that. Now, I don't have any deep worries about that, because I'm very convinced that God is real.
The only questions I think we'd have a difficult time with are, in fact, what G.K. Chesterton would call the peripheral questions. You might have a question like, well, what are you going to be doing in heaven for all eternity? Well, I have a general idea, but I can't demonstrate it. I can't prove it, but it's not like, geez, I don't know how to answer that question. Maybe Jesus didn't rise from the dead. Or any other number of questions like that. Maybe I can't answer the question, say, of free will. Well, okay, maybe I can't. But that doesn't change for me that Jesus rose from the dead. And as soon as I've got all the central questions answered, then all those peripheral questions are, well, that's not, is that something to discuss, but it doesn't change things. But when I look at atheism, it looks like the central questions are unanswered.
Right. I agree. The importance of questions is such that there's research out of Fuller Seminary's study into youth and religion that show that youth who grow up in an environment where they don't face questions are far more likely to fall away from the faith than youth who grow up with the ability to articulate doubt and to articulate questions. They're talking about youth who grew up in reasonably good Christian churches, and the ability and the opportunity and the freedom to articulate questions and doubts about the faith actually predicts more strong faith in adulthood than where people say you shouldn't talk about that. Churches sometimes are overly protective and to their own detriment by saying, we don't want you to doubt that. You just should believe. Well, the should believe thing just doesn't work.
I'm going to give a little plug for the church that Allie and I attend now at this point. We attend The Point here in Knoxville, and one thing I really liked about the service, because we were trying to find a church, and Allie went in with contemporary music, contemporary worship. She really likes opera. Okay, Yeah, but she knows I want to quit a church that's serious. Anyways, of course, she wants that too, but just that's her worship style, you know? And so, anyway, I looked and I find this one, and I find that on the webpage, there's something with the pastor answering questions. And these are hard questions, questions about evolution and homosexuality and such. And now, I didn't agree with every single answer, of course, but by and large, they were very good answers. In fact, you know, even if I don't agree, the questions are being answered. And when we go to the church service, there's an open message that says, very safe before any service, you know, if you have a question during the sermon, get out your phone, text it in, here's where to text it to, and we'll answer it at the end of the service. And right now we're going through a series, and we've got a Facebook page set up to answer for questions, and I've been one who's been allowed to help with answering questions. I mean, this is a great idea. Why don't more churches do this? And probably probably the reason a lot of churches don't do this is because they're not equipped to do it.
Right. So how do you get equipped? The answer to that is start anyway. If you don't know the answer to that, go ahead and open it up to the questions anyway. Here's what happens. When people are allowed to ask questions, or when I encounter questions, it's that it motivates me.
Yep.
When I've gone out into the public and just gone to people and said, what do you think of Jesus Christ? Who do you think he was? Who do you think he is? And I get these off-the-wall answers. I am motivated to go study.
You know, I'm not sure if you're like me in this regards, but if sometimes it can be very hard to pick up the books and read sometimes, but usually if I find myself I'm in a debate and all of a sudden I'm wanting to know more about the answer to those questions, I am far more driven to go and do that research then.
Yeah. Now here's where you press this even farther, this is something that I've suggested along with the warning that this is a great way for a pastor to get himself fired. What if the pastor left some questions unanswered at the end of the sermon?
Mm-hmm.
What if the congregation was a little uneasy? What if they weren't quite sure what the answer was? What if they were bothered? Okay, pastor's at risk of getting fired, but the people are also at risk of opening a book and reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, yeah, the pastor is doing what Jesus did if he leaves some questions unanswered sometimes.
Unfortunately, I've noticed too many Christians have exactly what I've called the escapist mentality, where it's this idea where I'm saved, my children are saved, so I'm not going to worry about what's going on. I'm just going to wait and let Jesus come and take us all home, and that'll be it. And I hear that, and I just get infuriated. I say, okay, you know, I'm happy you're in. I'm happy your children are in. But what about your neighbor? What about your neighbor's children? What about your children's children?
Nick, what about their own children? Do you think
that
that's a wise way for a parent to treat their own children? Do you think that that's going to work?
I was talking to a mentor of mine one time, and he was... And when I was talking to him, I suddenly got interrupted with a phone call from a pastor who I'd called offering my help in apologetics. And he said, nah, our children are good. We don't really need that right now. And I told this mentor that, and he said, he'll be calling you back in about a year and a half when his child comes home from college saying that he's abandoned the faith.
Right. And that has been known to happen. I've heard other apologists, I won't tell their story for them, say that they have had that exact same conversation, the year and a half later conversation with pastors whose children have left the faith.
Mm-hmm.
And raising a child is it's an inexact science. It's something that and they're people with their own free will and their own decision making. Mm-hmm. You can't make a formula that will make sure that your kid will follow in the footsteps of Christ.
Yeah.
But you can do things that make it more or less likely. And one of the ways to make it more likely for them to follow in the footsteps of Christ is to let them grapple with their questions. If they raise a question that you don't know the answer to, by the way, as a parent,
mm-hmm.
and you say, whoa, that's a good question, and then you look like you don't know what you're going to do next, you are poised for your biggest win as a parent at that point. Because if your mm-hmm. next sentence is, I don't know, let's see if we can figure this out, you're winning at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You're in a great place.
Or you can even say, I don't know, but let's go to the local library and see if they have any books on the topic.
Right.
You know,
go to the internet if you go to the right places. Or the wrong places. Just keep looking. Right.
And, you know, we could... You often say with so many people, if your child was getting beaten up by bullies a lot at school, where you can't have them depend on the teachers forever, you might go in and have them do something like, say, learn karate, for instance. If
mm-hmm.
you had someone who was a daughter who was working in an environment you thought was a dangerous environment, some, but she had to pass through it, you might give her pepper spray. Or give her a trainer so she could carry a concealed weapon. You're not going to just go up there and say, well, you'll be fine because you're my kid. You're going to want to make sure they're the best prepared that they can be. So why on earth would you send your students off to colleges that have a goal to destroy your child's faith and say, you don't need any training, you're going to be fine?
Right. Now, here's another side of how this connects with Peter Boghossian, too. Coming back around to him as a focal point of our discussion, when he says to us that faith is pretending to know things you don't know, when he says faith is belief without evidence, what he's doing is he's trying to change the landscape of the vocabulary such that certain topics are virtually impossible to discuss and certain questions cannot be asked.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if your child, suppose Boghossian succeeds to some extent, and you've got a lot of people out there thinking, okay, faith is belief without evidence, and you're a Christian parent, and you're saying to your kids, you really ought to be thinking about whether the faith is true and whether there's good reasons for faith, what the tape that's going to play in their head is this. They're going to translate that. And this is what he wants them to do. He instructs people to do is to translate it as this. The parent is speaking and the child hears the parent saying, you really ought to consider whether pretending to know what you don't know can lead you to the truth. All of a sudden, the question of whether there's truth to be found there becomes unaskable. Because the child is going to hear it in a way that wipes it out from even the cognitive territory of possible thoughts. It just wipes it out because he's changed the meaning of the word.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's trying to accomplish.
I've often said that he who controls the meaning of a word wins the game in the end.
It's happened with the word truth. It's happened with the word hate. with tolerance. And if it happens with the word faith, it puts us deep into a hole when it comes to discussing matters of the pretending to know things we don't know. I mean, when it comes to discussing matters of the faith.
Yeah. We're seeing a great example of this right now, in fact, in the marriage debate, because I often tell people, I'm opposed to redefining marriage. Say, oh, are you opposed to same-sex marriage? I say, you might as well say, I'm opposed to square circles. They don't exist, as far as I'm concerned. I'm opposed to redefining marriage. Now, see, I say it's something specific. You want to say it's something different, you have to make a case for why it's different. I'm not going to help you with that.
Right. So this is where, again, he's displaying his strategic insight and his tactical insight, which is he's aiming at a very strategic target. If he can redefine the word faith in the general conception of the word in the American public or the world public, then we're going to have to quit using that word. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to find another word for what we're trying to say. Because we don't want to be saying, my faith is, faith of our fathers is, the title of an old hymn. Pretending to know what they don't know of our fathers. You just don't want that flashing through the congregation's mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's
a very strategic target. We're going to take a quick break right now. My guest is Tom Gilson of Thinking Christian. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I would like people to remember that this work that we do here is listener-supported. And as you can tell from the week that we've had, we definitely could use your support here. And if you want to support Blog Talk Radio, you can do that through the CYI Worldwide Ministries. And if you want to support Deeper Waters in particular, you can go to my blog at deeperwaters.wordpress.com. There's a donate button there. But the best ways are to make donations through either tectonics.org or through Risen Jesus. And if you do those, stress both times that, I want this to go to Nick Peters of Deeper Waters. I'll make sure it gets here. Or you can go for the Ratio Christi Issues and Answers chapter, my own personal chapter where I handle work done on the Internet. And, Tommy, you wanted to talk some about Ratio Christi as well, didn't you?
Yeah, it's a huge privilege to be involved in this ministry. It's been picking up on a movement moment as people are more and more interested in apologetics, the defense of the faith, how we know that the faith is true. So that this movement was started just a few years ago in North Carolina and was incorporated, I think, 3 years ago now. It's coming up on that time frame, but it has already exploded to 100 and some campuses. As we give opportunity for students to learn about how they can become equipped in the confidence in the faith, become equipped in the ability to share that confidence, to be able to communicate that with others. There was one student at West Virginia University recently who spoke about going to a conference that we had helped to sponsor, and he said, after returning from the conference, I'm quoting now, "I went through a few of the topics with my brother. For the first time in my adult life, I was able to get through to him. There was an unprecedented spark of hope from him. By the end of the conversation, he told me that if and when I can develop a solid historical case for the resurrection, he would like to hear it. My mother was present for the conversation. As soon as she and I left the room, she started crying in her joy." This is the kind of equipping that we do as students.
Mm-hmm.
And what you and I are involved in, you can find out about my work on that. Really, the easiest way is to go to my Thinking Christian blog, thinkingchristian.net. But we are hosting or holding student chapter meetings in these universities, university-wide events. We're cooperating with other campus ministries in every way we possibly can to help provide our services, our particular niche to fill in the university, and we're just there to help students become equipped and engaged.
Now,
RatioChristi.org.
Now, getting back to Boghossian, I'd like to look at something he talks about on page 82, where he talks about, in the prior page, he's asked people what it would take to convince them that they're wrong. And he says, once they've given their response, I thank them. If they've asked me what it would take for me to believe, I use a variation of American physicist Lawrence Krauss's example in his debate with William Lane Craig. If I walked outside at night and all the stars were organized to read, "I am God communicating with you, believe in me," and every human being worldwide witnesses in their native language, this would be suggestive. And then he has in parentheses, but far from conclusive, as it's a perception and could be a delusion.
Right.
I find that an incredibly revealing statement.
It is. He actually strengthens that in a conversation he had with Richard Dawkins. It's available online, a YouTube video, Boghossian and Dawkins speaking at Portland State, where Dawkins says that even the return of Jesus Christ could be considered to be weak evidence for the existence of God. And Boghossian nods his head, apparently agreeing with him at that point. It was Dawkins' statement, but I think Boghossian goes along with him. And so, now, again, this, I was listening to him earlier today in a podcast, in an interview with, the name's escaping me, it was an online interview where he was talking over and over again about the importance of doxastic openness, which the importance of being willing to change your beliefs if presented with sufficiently powerful evidence. It's very important to him. He says it over and over again. And you know what? If this isn't doxastic closeness, being closed off doxastically, I don't know what is. I mean, he's not just talking about his own delusion. He's talking about, in the same quote you gave, if all the stars were organized to read, "I am God communicating with you," etc., and every human being worldwide witnessed this in their native language, that still wouldn't be really evidence to him. That's a guy who says he believes in doxastic openness but doesn't consider that potentially evidence is not telling the truth.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah.
You know, what it tells me when I see that is, I mean, my main arguments I use for God's existence are the five ways of Aquinas. And what that tells me is if I go up to Boghossian, I might as well say, don't bother, because you've already decided in advance the argument has to be wrong because you haven't had an experience. And yet I'm sure you're the one who says most Christians are coming to their faith because they've had an experience, and it's not because of reason.
Right. There's another layer to it, too, which is this, that he... In his talks and in his book about how to be a good street epistemologist, he emphasized the importance of being open to changing your mind. But what it looks like to me, when he is obviously not open to changing his mind, is that he's saying you need to have the appearance of sincerity. The old saying, you know, there's nothing more important than sincerity, and if you can't be sincere, at least fake it. you got to have sincerity, but if not, at least fake it. That's what he's really seeming to portray here, because he's not showing this this doxastic openness. He's not being open to listen to what other people say. He's decided, and he's closed off to the most extreme evidences.
You know,
but
what
he wants
to
make sure that people don't look that way.
Yeah. What I've actually done is I've kind of referred to it as an atheistic presuppositionalism.
Okay.
It's just pretty much you start off, atheism is true, therefore all the evidence must be construed in some way to fit with it, atheism, and if something doesn't fit with it, it doesn't count.
Right.
It has to be a delusion, something.
Right. Now, what would cause me to change my belief? I mean, that's a fair question. I don't have any fear of facing that question, and I don't agree with one answer that a lot of people give, the bones of Jesus Christ.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason I don't agree with that is because we'd still have to decide whether those really were the bones of Jesus Christ, and I could wiggle my way out of that one real easily. If someone brought me the bones of Jesus Christ, I could just say, nah, that's not what they are. Here's what would cause me to change my belief is if someone could provide me with a better explanation for the way the world is and a better explanation for the things that we read about and what scholarship supports about Jesus Christ, if someone could give me a better explanation, I'd go for it. The reason I accept Christianity is because it's a really, really powerfully effective way of understanding reality.
Mm-hmm.
And the Holy Spirit is in the mix there, too, in a way that I can't explain to a non-believer. But I can explain that much to a non-believer.
That's what I've said, in fact. But just give me a better explanation of the data, and that's what it will take. Now, he does, in fact, have a conversation where he talks with a professor at a seminary. He doesn't name him, which that was interesting to me, but I suppose that's also a professional courtesy. A lot of writers don't do that kind of thing. And
right.
You know, this Old Testament professor does say, the bones of Jesus. And I do agree, it does become an embarrassing conversation then.
Yeah. Now, if there was absolute proof that those were the bones of Jesus, yeah, okay. But I just don't think that anybody could absolutely prove that. What I need is something to show me that Christianity isn't the best explanation for reality.
Mm-hmm. Or you could even
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I come back to something Chuck Colson said I've heard him say it more than once, the late Chuck Colson, that he quizzed some theologians in England about this and said, what's the definition, or what is Christianity, rather? And they came back with answers all over the map, and even the conservative Christians didn't give the answer he thought was true. And he said, and I agree, having heard it, Christianity is the explanation for everything.
Mm-hmm.
It covers not that it explains, you know, why thermostats work, but it explains the background behind everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you can attack that successfully, then I'll give up Christianity.
You know, we usually encounter atheists, I think, who fought Christianity for not doing things it wasn't supposed to do. Like, for instance, where it doesn't give us a scientific explanation of a universe, where it's not supposed to. That's the job of science. I would say Christianity gives us a foundation for studying science and finding out the answer to that question, but it's not meant to answer that question. That'd be just like faulting the scientific community for not being able to explain to us how we understand Shakespeare.
Right. Of course, some scientists would say, well, that's really, everything's in our domain, and we just haven't gotten to that one yet. But no, that's not a proper understanding of science, or of Shakespeare, or of humanness.
There is always, it seems, a scientism going on behind this. I mean, that's why I've even said in me and my own blog post that I'm fine with whatever you can show me can be demonstrated by science. I'm not necessarily fine with everything that you think is an interpretation of that data.
Right.
I mean, if you could show me, for instance, macroevolutionary theory is true, well, I'm fine with that. Okay, it's not going to cause me a problem. But at the same time, I'm not going to look at that and say, where, therefore, theism is untrue. That doesn't follow from that evidence.
Right. We've got one discipline, you know, tumbling over into another in ways that, that just doesn't belong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Nick, I wonder if we ought to talk about the containment protocols that he suggests in the end of his book. His chapter 9 of The Manual for Creating Atheists, he begins after an epigraph. He says, just as the body is exposed to toxins, so is the mind. Faith is an unclassified cognitive illness disguised as a moral virtue. Each of us dreads the thought of becoming ill, and we take whatever measures necessary to regain our health. Not so with the faith virus. People infected by faith feel gratitude and appreciation for their affliction. And so he talks about, how are we going to dislodge this virus? Well, maybe we can't, but we can at least contain it. And I know you've read this. Have you ever seen anything that looks quite so much like hate language is what he says in this containment protocols chapter?
Well, I'd be skeptical of using the term hate language since that's been redefined, but yeah, I'd say very hostile language is being used.
You caught me there. I accept that correction. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But what were you saying again?
I'd say hostile language is being used.
Hostile language, yes. Right. So he says, use the word faith only in a religious context. So does Nick Peters have faith in Allie? No. Can't use that word.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because he said so.
Right.
He says, stigmatize faith-based claims like racist claims. So racist statements are stigmatized now. You can't use certain words, even in an innocent, with innocent intent, because you will get really, really thrown out on your ear from most contexts. And he wants people to be treating faith-based claims the same way. And he goes so far as to say that, I'm quoting page 212, in the short term, one specific verbal technique to help contain faith-based justifications for knowledge is through the, quote, adult table response. One can sit at the adult table if one has evidence in support of a position. Absent evidence, the claimant needs to go to the kids table. And he says later in a paragraph, waive an ancient text and expect others to go along with its authority or claim faith as a justification for your beliefs, you need to sit at the kids' table. Those at the kids' table can talk about anything they'd like, but they have no adult responsibilities and no voice in public policy. That's hostile.
You know, actually, I've had a lot of fun with this kind of statement, because when I've been engaging with these street epistemologists, I'll so often use Boghossian's own words and say, well, you know, you need to practice some more doxastic openness and stop pretending to know things you don't know. And, well, if you don't have any data for your position, then please go sit at the kids' table, okay? It works great to use their own mentor against them.
Yeah. Another thing that's going on there, too, where people are violating their own values, is that what they're doing there is they're stereotyping us badly. They're saying that we have, you know, we're claiming faith as the justification for our beliefs. They don't know that for sure. They're just assuming that about the whole group of Christians. It's kind of like, well, you know, they're all stupid. They all believe that the world was created just, you know, 100 years ago. I'm exaggerating. But, you know, we're all stupid. We're all believing things based on pretense. We're all really kind of idiotic. And it's almost like, well, you know, they all look the same to me. It's bigoted stereotyping, and if they saw themselves in the reality of that stereotyping behavior, I think some of them would feel uncomfortable about it.
Yeah, I think what's even more concerning is when you look at his reasons, such as number 8, where he says, treat faith as a public health crisis.
Right, yes.
Now, I think we're getting close to a systematic destruction there at that point. Especially when you tie between number 11, where he says, remove a faith exemption from the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, in which he's saying pretty much treat all people who claim faith as if they're mental conditions, as if they're diseases. Now, that is definitely getting to controlling dangerous talk.
Right. Right. And he has... He has recently, again, in interviews, described his, he's described this as, it was Stephen Molyneux, by the way, is the name of the person I was trying to come up with earlier. He says that this is a species-threatening moment, that faith is a matter of the future of the species, and if we don't get rid of faith, that's going to be really dangerous for the human race.
So we've got to contain it. Let's pause on that for a little bit. We're going to take a break, come back, we'll wrap things up, and we'll talk about that point, okay?
Okay. Yep.
Okay. I'm Nick Peters. My guest is Tom Gilson. We'll be back right after this.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That, again, is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast, bringing you the best in apologetics out there. And my guest today is Tom Gilson. We're talking about Peter Boghossian. Now, he's talking about containing faith, that this is a crisis moment for our species and such. And it leaves me wondering, how far are you willing to go with this? I mean, are you talking about people like you and I should be locked up somewhere, that we should be treated as if we're diseases? How far?
Right. Well, you mentioned, and this came in the context of what you mentioned about his point 8 in his containment protocols. On page 217 of his book, he says, we need to treat it as a public health crisis. We must reconceptualize faith as a virus of the mind and treat like faith like other epidemiological crises, contain and eradicate. Sam Harris has said something that along the same lines. We need to eradicate faith. Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens said something like that in a conversation shortly before Hitchens' death. We need to, that victory would be destroying Christianity. How do you do that?
I'm thinking, are we on the lines of saying the final solution, for instance?
I wonder what's in their mind, because you can't just eradicate faith with street epistemologists. He must know better than to think that that's possible. But he wants to redefine it in the psychological and psychiatric literature as a disease. They did that kind of thing in Soviet Russia with, they treated dissidents, quote, unquote, with chemicals. At least that's the story that came out during the communist era. Whether it's true or not, about Soviet Russia, the thought of it happening to us today seems to be perfectly in line with the idea of treating it as a mental disorder. You treat it.
I also thought it was interesting that he suggested that parents raise their children up as atheists. Now, really, I don't have a problem with that, because I think if you're an atheist parent and you think atheism is true, that's what you teach your children. That doesn't surprise me. But the same in when Richard Dawkins sees Christians raising up their children as Christians, he calls that child abuse. But when atheists raise up their children as atheists, that's A-okay.
Right. And the Dawkins argument is really ironic, because he was, at the time he wrote that, he was a professor for the public understanding of science at Oxford University. That is a completely science-free opinion of his. There is, to say that there's no evidence that raising children as Christians, I'm going to back this up and start over again. You could say that there's no evidence that this is child abuse, but that would be a gross understatement of the reality. The strong evidence, especially coming out of the National Study on Youth and Religion, headed by Christian Smith, the very, very strong evidence is that kids who are devoted in their beliefs, in their spiritual belief, are healthier than kids who are detached or unengaged in spiritual things. He actually, in this study, he measured 99 different measures of academic, relational, social, spiritual, mental health, and the devoted group came out healthier than the disengaged group on all 99 measures. That's not a symptom of having been abused.
Right.
Children who have been abused do not come out healthier than children who were not abused. Mm-hmm. Dawkins made a completely anti-scientific statement when he said that that's abuse. I think it's ironic. I think it's almost hilarious. I'm laughing.
It's just part of this idea that I noticed with atheism, and I think it's a large part of what's going on with the whole Christ myth idea of popular in atheist circles, that if there's anything that could lead any support to Christianity being true, where that has to be stamped out immediately, you can't give it a single inch whatsoever. I mean, I've been tempted to say to these people, in fact, I'm pretty sure I have said, some people said, you know, there are many atheists who come to believe in a historical Jesus and go on to lead happy and meaningful lives.
Sure. Now, here's the question, too. I think that I've been speaking in very strong language about the errors of the atheist thought leaders like Dawkins and Boghossian. Are we being fair to them? And here's the thing that I don't want to forget, and I want to make sure I mention at the end of this 2 hours together, is that it's a very difficult balance to maintain. The arguments that they bring against the God whom we love are really poor arguments, and they're really disrespectful, dishonoring towards God, who is God and whom we love. And I think that we need to go at those arguments right at the throat.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you know, if I had a chance to sit down next to Peter Boghossian on an airplane, I wouldn't be just doing some tactic of acting friendly, which is what he seems to propose towards, you know, for street epistemologists. I would hope that I came out of that not just looking like I cared for him, but really caring for him.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to distinguish his arguments and his beliefs from the man himself. Am I very good at that? I probably need a lot more practice. I think Jesus did that, and he's my model. Am I all the way as good as Jesus? Well, I'm maybe looking the right direction some of the time, but I'm a long way from the destination. But that's what we're about as Christians, too. So, you know, the arguments are awful, but the people are loved by God. How do we deal with that? Boy, we could work on that.
You know, one thing we should say is the arguments are awful, but they're convincing at the same time because we've done a poor job educating the church and equipping the church. So since we've talked so much about the problem, let's talk some about the solution. What can we do to equip our churches?
I think the pastors need to be asking more questions and leaving people wondering about the answers.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think pastors need to be directing them to places they can find the answers. The reason I'm starting with questions rather than with answers is because of the motivational factor of questions. That people don't really care about answers until they've cared about the questions.
Mm-hmm.
So if I could persuade church leadership to do anything, it would be to emphasize more questions, but to have access to the answers where people can get to them. That's my number one piece of advice for the church, is be comfortable with questions. Let them hang out there until people have to have the answers, and then they'll get them.
You know, something also something I'd like to see done also is I see so many churches that have ministers of music, ministers of education, ministers of administration. We need churches that have ministers of apologetics.
Yeah, I that word is so unfamiliar. I'd rather have it be ministers of questions or ministers of, I don't know, that's probably not the right word either, but I would rather have it be the question equipper or something like that, because I'm so convinced of the power of questions, as long as you've got your answers too.
Mm-hmm.
We need to also make sure that youth are in particular encouraged and feel safe to raise questions, and we really need to equip them with answers in training mode. as J. Warner Wallace puts it so well, we've got to put them in simulations where they're dealing with the questions and they've got someone coaching them on how to get to the answers. Because if you just tell them the answers, they're not going to have them in a usable, ready state when they get to where they need them. That's another big deal.
Too often, we're turning our youth groups, I think, into big social clubs where we take them to pizza parties and Christian concerts and things of that sort. And there's a time and place for those kinds of things, but having all the pizza parties in the world is not going to equip them when they get to college.
Right. It's going to equip them to seek out for fun. And, you know, believe it or not, in college they have fun, too, and they have fun with a completely different spiritual background. And they're offering a different kind of fun. So if that's what you want to equip your youth for, watch out. Not such
as,
a good idea.
As Don Johnson and I spent the last 20 minutes of our show discussing last week, the sexual revolution coming through is going to is causing a whole lot of trouble, and that is one of the biggest drives, I think, to get people to abandon Christianity, especially youth, because of our tight restrictions, as it's seen in that area. You say, well, I want to go out and have my fun. I can't have that and Christianity both. So bye-bye Christianity.
Yeah. Right.
And now we do church need to do this. Parents, especially, need to do it. The churches can fail, but and unfortunately they too often do, but the responsibility also lies with the parents.
Right. And the best thing parents can do is to have discover ways to find access to answers and then open up questions with their kids. You know, for good access to answers, my favorite book these days now is the J. Warner Wallace book called Case Christianity. There are others that are really good, too. Mark Middleberg's got a book on 10 questions that Christians hope no one will ask and with answers. These things are really good resources to have on hand, but the most important thing a parent can do is to open up the conversation with their children.
J. Warner Wallace, I should point out, was on our show. I believe it was back in July 6th this year. And I have corresponded with Mark Middleberg about having him come on the show as well. So for people listening, if you're interested in Mark Middleberg coming on, well, stay tuned. I hope it'll be sometime soon.
Right. Oh, that'd be great.
I definitely
he's a really good one for connecting people.
Yeah. Cold Case Christianity is certainly a great one. In fact, I taught a class up in Indiana via Skype recently, and they said, what book should we go through today? I said, well, the latest one to come up, I think, would be the best one, would be Cold Case Christianity.
Right.
And that's what we did.
Yeah. Yeah. He's done a marvelous job with that one.
And I've also said, certainly, if your pastor is unable to equip you, if he's unable to answer these kinds of questions, get a new pastor. Because your pastor is supposed to be the shepherd of the flock, and he can't defend the flock if he doesn't have answers to these questions. And too often, we're settling for the lowest common denominator with pastors who don't have any clue. And frankly, I've told him, if you don't have a clue about this kind of stuff, you have no business being in the pulpit.
Right. And they don't have to teach, quote, unquote, apologetic sermons. The natural way to do it is to teach, you know, maybe you're an expository preacher who likes to go through the Bible book by book or chapter by chapter. That's great. You don't have to teach a directly apologetic sermon. But when you encounter something in that passage that's going to be confusing to people in your congregation or among your community, if it's going to be the kind of thing where they're going to say, I don't know how that could be true, I don't know how that makes sense, ask the question out loud and say, you know, this is a question you might be asking or your friends might be asking. Here's how I would address it. Then I would go to the, you know, once you've raised that question, I'd move to the answer. And
yes.
And just bring the question out in the open, because it's not, because it's out in the open somewhere near you.
And what I've told pastors is, you don't have to be a specialist in apologetics. You don't have time for that necessarily. Know the basics, at least, and also have someone
right.
in your congregation you can point to who can help.
Perfect.
And it's so important to have these questions. I mean, heck, last Sunday in our church, we heard a sermon on the conquest of the Promised Land, asking a hard question about the talk about genocide and such as well. And I was just so amazed when the sermon started. But I'm actually hearing a sermon about this. I never hear
wonderful.
That in churches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Boy, and that one's a hot one out in the internet.
Mm-hmm. Tom, we've got a little less than 5 minutes left, so it's time to be wrapping things up. What's the final message you would really like to leave with the listening audience here?
Well, there's a lot of them tumbling over in my mind, but I think the main one is to develop the ability to face questions about your faith and to discover ways to get them answered. So that when someone like a street epistemologist, one of Boghossian's supposed disciples, I guess we could call them, comes up and asks you, how do you know such and so, that you're not caught flat-footed. And then develop the ability to have conversations with the people in your church and the people in your family about these kinds of things. Go ahead and ask these questions. Let
mm-hmm.
them flow. And then be willing to look up the answers, because these things matter. William Wilberforce said, without having the quote at hand, but he said something about how parents would blush to send their kids out into the world unequipped for their vocations, but they're willing to send them out unequipped to answer the basic questions about Christianity. Why is that? We need to realize that this is part of our responsibility as Christian leaders, whether we're church leaders or parents. Boghossian
mm-hmm.
and other new atheists have this, have developed this brand for themselves as being the party of reason, but that's just not an accurate description of who they are. And we need to be able to challenge that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, I do want to thank you for coming on the show today. I hope, first off, that you've enjoyed your time here, and second, I hope that you'll want to come back sometime.
Thank you. I hope that you'll invite me.
Mm-hmm. Well, whenever another work comes out in such in the future, let me know, and we'll see what we can do here. Now, I'd like to, as we're getting ready to sign off, I'd like to remind everyone, next week, Lynn Kohick of Wheaton is going to be my guest. We're going to be talking about Jesus and women. Should be a fascinating show. Make sure all your feminist friends are listening to this one. So now, I'm Nick Peters, the Deeper Waters Podcast, and signing off until next time.